Hi, podcast listeners. Before we get today's episode started, Joanne and I have a little bit of an announcement to make, a debrief, if you will, about our last episode.
Yeah, we heard from someone through ACBS, someone emailed ACBS regarding a comment that I had made during the podcast with Jessica. They took exception to hearing the words fat, disgusting pig. And we just wanted to talk a little bit about that, about what was intended. What I would like to talk about is the holding both the intent of what was meant to be done and acknowledging also the effect of how it landed for another person. So we're going to try to talk about that, and also to invite that person to come on the podcast with us and just talk about it. All right. So what are your thoughts, Tim?
Well, if I may just go through the chain of action. So for our listeners, in our last episode, so that would actually be episode 14 with Jessica Borshak, our guest, we were talking about ACT in behavioral medicine and especially around issues for health as a value and weight loss. Mm-hmm. Now, for me personally, this issue resonates with me because there are a lot of derogatory things that I say about myself. And we were about 33 minutes into the episode, Joanne, when you were talking about losing weight as a goal versus value. And it was really personally profound to me when I was...
Well, what I was actually saying is how we motivate ourselves to make big changes.
That's correct.
And how we get we slide very easily into punishing, which works very well short term, but not long term. And I was just walking through how it just doesn't work.
Yeah, well, and what was profound to me personally is that resonated with me. This idea, like a client may say to themselves, and that's what you were saying about 33 minutes into the episode, right? Yeah. You were going through this inner monologue that someone can have when they're really fused with this nasty kind of self-content. I hope it's okay that I'm making that judgment, that it's nasty words that we use with ourselves.
Oh, it's vicious. It's absolutely vicious. And that what disgusting fat pig is not the worst I've ever said to myself or that I've heard other people say to themselves, right?
Same.
I mean, disgusting fat pig sometimes is like a good day for me.
Yeah.
When I'm really caught up in this narrative around, self is content.
Yeah. And so what happened about 33 minutes in is you were using that term.
Disgusting fat pig.
Disgusting fat pig. In order to describe this inner monologue that someone might be using, like aversive form of control on oneself.
Right. Which works short term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I've done it myself. That's why it stood out to me so profoundly. Like, that's why it really touched me. And this idea that you could use that as a motivator to get you to lose weight in the moment.
Right.
In our last episode that we had just recorded, I actually talked about how I'm the most out of shape now that I have ever been in my entire life. And when sometimes when I see myself naked in the mirror, the guttural reaction that I have, there's quite a few curse words that are involved in that as well.
Right.
Exactly. There really are.
Exactly. Exactly. Right.
And I think what the unintended consequence may be is that I think when you replay that episode and you hear that passage, I think if you only listen to that passage, it's actually really jarring.
Yeah, it is jarring.
And I think what's important about that to understand is that, to me at least, and it may not be clear to all of our listeners, that wasn't you referring to other people.
No.
That was an example.
That was an example. But I think, if you're listening and that is part of your history, it comes across as, I understand how it can land really wrong.
Yeah.
Someone hearing it really wrong. Not in the way it was intended. So I'm clear about my intention, but I'm also really aware that some of the stuff that we talk about in this podcast, that's one example of it, is jarring and disturbing and upsetting. And it's perfectly reasonable to me that someone would be listening to a podcast and all of a sudden they would hear that and it would just be like, what?
How could Joanne say that?
Well, they don't know me. So I mean, how could anyone say that? How could anyone who's, an ACT person say something like that. And I think that's part of what am I trying to say here? I'll say this to you a lot, Tim. I need to say this in my out loud voice so I can hear the crazy, right?
Sure.
We talk about this all the time. We did this earlier today, right?
That's right.
And sometimes saying what my mind is telling me in the out loud voice, I can hear the viciousness. I can hear the insanity of it, but it needs to be said out loud. And disgusting fat pig needs to be said out loud. Right now, I'm standing in front of the mirror, looking at my body, which is doing the absolute best it knows how to do, that deserves my respect and love. And I'm using the words disgusting fat pig. That's what I'm doing right now. That's what my mind is giving me right now.
Yeah.
That's and I think if you say it out loud, you could, you know, your heart can break. You know? Our bodies deserve so much love from us, and they just don't get it. We don't give our bodies love at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? We don't. We look at it. I mean, as I'm aging, I'm looking at my body and thinking, oh God, curse words are just the beginning of it, right? No?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And just this, and when if I unpack it as I look at the changes in my body, you know, if I get underneath the disgust, I come up around fear, around getting older, about, you know, being more frail, about my body not being as sturdy as it used to be, and all of the kind of viciousness we talk about women who are older. I mean, you don't hear women who are older talked about in a way that's supportive and loving of bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And you have such a, as a man, you have such a narrow niche to fit in to.
That's right.
That's attractive. You have almost no variation. Women have a lot more variation than men do, I think, in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. If your body isn't that perfect V, you're not, you're not attractive. You're not attractive.
Yeah. And so we also wanted to, you alluded to this earlier, well, you mentioned it earlier, this idea that we welcome your feedback from people.
Absolutely.
We welcome your questions.
Absolutely.
Email us directly, actingcontextpodcast@gmail.com. And we would love to have a dialogue with the folks who have ideas, questions, concerns, and even invite you onto the podcast.
Yes.
I think we're very open to acknowledging when we may be blurring some lines or if we get something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be really helpful to actually be able to have a dialogue and demonstrate some openness to that discomfort and some sensitivity to the context, like we're trying to do right now.
Yeah, like we're trying to do right now. So thank you so much for your continued thoughts and listening and patience with us as we figure out how to do this together.
Yeah.
We did it again, Tim.
That's right. Yeah. And it matters. So thank you, folks. And thank you, Joanne, for being flexible and taking some time to address this before we launch this week's episode. I hope you enjoy the episode, folks.
Me too. Take good care, all.
All right. Let's roll that intro.
Okay.
Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Tim Gordon.
And my name's Joanne Steinwachs.
We're here with a really exciting episode. And just to remind you folks, before we get started and Joanne introduces our guest, I want to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at Acting Context, or email us with your questions, things that you want us to talk about. Maybe you even want to send us an audio message with your own questions or feedback. actingcontextpodcast@gmail.com.
I'm delighted to introduce my colleague and I think friend and co-traveler, Dr. Jenna Lejeune. Jenna and I have known each other several years now, I think probably 12, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've always enjoyed about Jenna is her deep, 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 deep roots in clinical work. I mean, she, I think in many ways, is first and foremost a clinician, which I find so lovely. So Jenna and her husband.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. I can use that word.
Yes. Officially as of 2 years ago. Yes.
Well, I just, I didn't know how you guys like to
refer
to yourselves. Yes. Jenna and her husband, Jason Luoma, have founded the Portland Psychotherapy Clinic, which is actually also something we really want to talk about in the podcast because it's quite extraordinary what's going on there.
So cool.
And so Jenna, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's so nice to see you again. Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's really nice to be able to talk to you, Joanne, and Tim as well. So thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jenna. And you know, I'm a huge fan of your work. We had you on the webinar series and I was just gaga over the session that you gave on doing values work in ACT. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Could you speak to what that webinar series is, Tim? So for people who don't know.
Yeah, I used to host an ACT webinar series. So what we would do is have different presenters come on for 2 hours at a time. Joanne, you and I were involved with that and gave some presentations as a part of that as well.
We were.
And what we had done is just brought on different people who were doing some innovative stuff.
Oh, right.
Yeah, to give an hour and a half sort of didactic presentation. And then we would do like a half hour kind of debrief and discussion. And Jenna was, I think, I'm not working with the company that was doing that anymore, but Jenna, last time that I was taking a look at our metrics, I think was the hands down. I'm noticing that cringy look on your face, Jenna. You were the most popular webinar presenter.
That's super cool.
I do think that's a little bit like, though, professors' ratings. If you teach abnormal psychology, you're going to get higher professor ratings than if you teach stats. And, you know, talking about values, people just like values. So I kind of have a leg up on that one.
But. Maybe. But people can talk about values in a way that sucks all the life out of the room, too.
Oh, good. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. I think you just need to take that compliment, Jenna.
Yes.
Your work and examples were innovative and fun. I still use one of the metaphors that you used in that webinar to this day. I was just working with clients this morning, which is the dollar store metaphor, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Right? You've got $8 in your pocket. You're walking around. There's a lot of attractive stuff that you want to pick up, but like you got a limited budget here. Where are you going to spend, you know, what you've got on what's valuable to you here?
Yeah.
I like
that's
that.
A great metaphor.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks.
I'm stealing it. It's mine now.
Totally.
Okay. So how do we want to begin? How do we want to start? Is there anything, Tim, you really have a burning desire to ask about for Jenna?
Yeah. I mean, before we started started rolling on the podcast, I'm so curious to hear about, because my background is in attachment work, and we've talked about this on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. Joanne, you talked about being immersed in a psychoanalytic tradition. I come from a kind of psychoanalytic, more psychodynamic background, but attachment is my home base. I mean, I was trained in that. I was rocking that for years. And Jenna, I would love to hear about how did you get into this very geeky behavioral work? And because we were talking a little bit about your background in attachment, and you're a day one ACT person, like
yeah,
you were in it before the book was out, you know, the cornerstone 1999 acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah. So my interest in attachment stuff, that was mostly like, I spent all 4 years of my undergrad, long nights in the lab coding strange situations. So I really have paid my dues in the attachment world. So I did kid attachment kind of stuff with that. And then later on, I worked with a researcher in undergrad who was doing adult attachment stuff. So we were looking at newly married or partnered couples and some attachment
stuff. So cool.
Yeah,
and so a lot of people don't recognize, Jenna, that there is a big difference in the literature between parental, like child attachment work, and romantic attachment. Like it is night and day different.
Yeah, very different. And I've always been,
for those of us who aren't as deeply immersed as you two attachment geeks, can you give us a little bit of information about how different it is and what the differences are?
Oh. I mean, you're asking me to go back 25 years here because I am not. I mean, my interest in the attachment world is some sort of coming back full circle because I'm also interested in EFT and have some EFT training. So,
right on.
So there's that kind of comes back around. But I think the idea, original idea, you know, with kind of Bowlby in that is that kids have to form this secure attachment with their primary caregivers, and then sort of they're good to go for the rest of their lives, and it's sort of set in stone. And right. And with kind of the newer stuff about adult attachment, there's this idea that like we're kind of constantly having to reattach and reestablish those bonds, especially with the primary people in our life, and that our attachment styles can actually change over the course of life, but also change in relationships.
Can it also change depending on context too?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that's something that sort of the old guard attachment, kid attachment folks, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to speak for them. And again, I am not an expert.
Okay.
But I think that wasn't sort of their focus. It was more like you're attached securely as a kid and then you're good to go or you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. And that very much is kind of my perspective, like from learning attachment early on as well, this ecological model that wasn't whatsoever meant to be clinically applied. It was really just meant to kind of predict patterns, like a behavioral system, just kind of patterns of interacting.
Yeah.
And I think that the romantic attachment stuff, especially with EFT, is so fascinating because we're talking about like moving, like pushing the meter on attachment in people and how they interact, which is really
smart. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool stuff. Yeah. So I was really interested in that in undergrad. This isn't going to surprise you, Joanne, because you will know this about me, but I'm very interested in relationship with people. Like that's sort of where my heart is. And that's the interest in attachment stuff. And so when I went to graduate school, I just sort of wanted to do anything in the relationship world of things. And I eventually ended up working with George Bonanno around bereavement and couples.
Wow, bereavement.
Yeah.
What was that work like?
Again, a lot of coding. Our research was around facial expressions. We did these kind of micro facial expression coding during bereavement where the bereaved person would talk about their deceased loved one. And we were kind of looking at things like the prevailing idea at the time was that healthy bereavement looks like you are only talking about and showing more positive emotions. And so we were looking at, you know, what happens when people are showing anger or showing, you know, that sort of stuff.
You're breathing in a healthy way.
Exactly. Yeah. But, oh gosh, it's the whole gamut of emotions there. So that's what I was doing in graduate school. And I had mentioned before the podcast started, I went to a program, I went to the Catholic University of America in DC with my partner, Jason, and it is kind of an integrated program. It's not a like hardcore behavioral program at all, but you know, it's not analytic. And in my first year, a really amazing director of clinical training, Diane Arnkoff, she just gave us a whole bunch of articles about sort of new and different types of therapy. And this was in, must have been 97 or 98.
Uh-huh. And before the first ACT book came out.
Yeah, before the first ACT book. And she gave us, our class, an article that Steve had written.
Is it Making Sense of Spirituality or?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. And I don't even remember what the article was, but I do remember, so there were five of us in our class, or six of us, and if there were six of us, five of us hated it, including, I thought, what the hell is
this? Makes sense.
And the thing that I didn't like about it was this idea of creative hopelessness, and it just scared me. And you know, being an attachment person, I'm like, oh no, I want to like create secure bonding experiences, and I don't want the person to feel hopeless around me. And Jason was actually the only one in our cohort that was interested in that. He thought, oh, this is fantastic. But I can be a little bit stubborn, and well, if my boyfriend at the time is interested in this, well, I'm not going to be interested in it. I'm not going to follow what Jason is interested in. So for
a frame of opposition there.
Oh, it was. It was like, yeah, that's great for you, but I'm not interested in that.
Oh, honey, you're so cute when you're wrong.
Right. So he was getting much deeper into the ACT world, probably for maybe two or three years before
I
finally said, fine, I'll go to my first training. And I went to one of Kelly Wilson's like infamous Mississippi intensives.
I've been to those.
Yes, right.
Oh, wow.
And then I was
so that's not going to a seminar. That's not like dipping your toe. That's head first. That's a dunk.
That's right. And I think, you know, I think it makes sense that if what I didn't, you know, I had a lot of preconceived ideas about what behaviorism is that I didn't like. Yeah, I did not want to be running rats through mazes. I thought it was very sort of dehumanizing and didn't pay attention.
It really only applied to people on the autism spectrum.
Absolutely.
Or doesn't believe in thoughts and feelings. I legitimately thought that behaviorists straight up didn't believe in the rich emotional world inside of us.
Absolutely, yeah. And so if you're coming at ACT sort of with that idea of what behaviorism is, then going to a Kelly Wilson workshop is a really good way.
It blows that completely out of water.
Like, wait, you're a behaviorist? There's a lot of crying happening here. Yeah, so that was sort of my entry into my very like stubborn entry into the ACT world.
So I want to make two comments really quickly. Comment number one, when you were an undergrad, that means, because if you were in grad school, like in the 90s, later part of the 90s, when you were an undergrad doing this strange situation, like the coding, that meant, were you involved doing that before the disorganized attachment style was?
Yeah, we didn't have, that wasn't part of our coding. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Thanks.
But that's really cool.
Okay, for people who don't know, who can't geek with you, talk about what that means. Why that's so cool.
Do you want to talk about it, Tim?
Well, just that there were these, if I may, and I'm going to let my, you know, Canadian-ness kind of come out here a little bit. I don't know if the world is...
Just do it. Don't be Canadian. Just do it.
That's right. So Mary Ainsworth, a lot of people say that she was a student of Bowlby's, but she wasn't. She was a totally dope, just rock and roll researcher on her own, doing this ecological research on matriarchy and families in on the African continent. And
she has an anthropology background as well, right? Doesn't she? Yeah. Doesn't she have some... Yeah.
And she had come up with these three sort of subtypes of attachment, right? Secure attachment, avoidant, and then a sort of anxious and ambivalent attachment style. And it wasn't until later on in the later part of the 90s that this fourth attachment style, which was called the disorganized one in the strange situation, had come out. And when I had done my attachment training, that was a brand new term.
Oh, yeah.
And when we were doing the strange situation, I remember like I was reading in the literature and in our training about, you know, you'll see children in this disorganized attachment style with unresolved trauma who will turn towards their caregiver in this strange situation and they'll go to approach them. But there's this moment of like, of terror and fear, like, will my needs get met? And can I trust this person? And they'll sort of then turn away. And it almost looks like a confused interaction. Mm-hmm. And right. It was a really profound moment in my life, like doing one of these assessments and seeing a child with a pretty severe trauma history, lots of preverbal trauma and going to turn towards their caregiver, to as a source of security and then sort of almost
and
recoiling
flinch.
Physically going to turn away but coming back, this conflict.
No, we were just doing the three, just coding the original three, I think. Yeah.
Tim, maybe we could put a little bit of quick reading in the show notes for people who are interested in going deeper into attachment theory. Just, some bullet point stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So wherever you consume your podcast, or if you're watching this as a video, we'll put it in the description or in the show notes, some links about some attachment stuff that you can read up on and geek out, have some fun.
Cool.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. And the second thing I wanted to comment on, Jenna, was, so when you were getting into ACT, when you had first read about it, I could totally relate to you being turned off by this concept of like creative hopelessness. And yeah. You weren't a behaviorist at the time.
Mm-mm.
So now, how did they win you over?
You know, I can't remember. I don't remember if I was already, how deep I was already into ACT, but I can tell you the moment that I totally flipped with behaviorism and thought all of my kind of old preconceived notions are shattered. And it was pretty early on, but I may have already done some early trainings in that. And I forget who told me the Skinner quote of the rat is always right. Mm-hmm. But the moment I heard that quote, everything just sort of changed for me. And that's actually a super impactful quote for me even now. And it's one that I'll actually tell my clients sometimes. My clients know me very well, and they know when I'm talking about non-human animals, I often, like, it's with terms of endearment, so they don't mind me calling them rats. Mm-hmm. But there was something, I had always seen behaviorism as this almost dehumanizing.
Coercive.
Coercive, and we're just a bunch of sort of like robots type thing. And this idea that the rat is always right, that we are always doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing, that I am not inherently bad or damaged or evil in some way. I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, given my learning history.
And given the context.
And given the context, exactly, and like current learning history, your current context, was so unbelievably humanizing for me. It kind of put everybody on this even playing field, that if I had the same current and past learning context as the person who's sitting across from me, I'd be cutting all over myself too.
Yeah, absolutely.
She isn't categorically different than I am. And so that was the moment that I thought, okay, behaviorism has something to teach me about how to sort of be a better human being in that way. And that's what I think sort of shifted me to saying, well, I like ACT, but I'm not a behaviorist, because I used to do that. And now
I have this real similar experience, Jenna. Oh. Coming out of the analytic community, there's a, you know, let's describe it beautifully. The analytic community describes situations and interactions very beautifully, not always, but oftentimes. And that's where we stop.
Oh, yeah.
Describe, explain. And, you know, if you understand that this is your DDD, then, you know, you're sort of fixed. And that sense underlying that from my position, I'm sure there are people out there who will disagree with me, that like the strange, like attachment style, attachment disorders, you know, like they start when you're an infant and that's just it. Sorry, you're screwed.
Right. You know?
And so the idea that we would learn and change, and it was so freeing for me, because I actually at that point really fulfill the diagnostic criteria for both narcissistic and borderline personality disorder. Which really sucked, you know? It was really hard to move through the world, anyway, in my mind, you know?
Yeah, and especially when you have that idea that you're stuck.
This isn't who I am.
Yeah. Right.
This is what I know how to do. The one quote that I like from Skinner that I think is really profoundly about relationship, and I'm going to mangle it. It is only when a man's internal events, private events, emotions, thoughts, and feelings become of interest to others that they become of interest to him.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Right. Isn't that beautiful? And it actually talks, that's what therapy is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And yet when I thought about behaviorism, like I really didn't think relationship had any role in it.
No.
Naturally, right?
Based on
what we're taught and how we're socialized. Yeah.
Yeah.
Both those quotes, like that's like poetry, right? Like the rat is always right. And how like, I love that you use that with your clients, Jenna. And I love the quote that you shared as well, Joanne. It's just so respectful and so very much appreciative of where people are.
Yeah. And I think if you come from that position when living, but definitely doing clinical work, your first stance when you're faced with some, you know, on the surface, really odd and incomprehensible behavior is to say, how does this make sense?
Exactly.
Which is a totally different way of saying, you know, your behavior is inappropriate, one of my least favorite words.
And, or maladaptive.
You know, yes. As opposed to, well, how, in what sort of worldview or understanding of the situation would this be a beautiful and elegant solution?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. And I think that's part of how I talk with my clients about that quote. I, you know, we all start from a set of assumptions and we just sort of choose the assumptions we start from. And so I start from this set of assumptions that the rat is always right. And therefore, starting from that place allows me to say, okay, my first job then is to figure out how does this make sense? Because it clearly does, because I have that assumption. This makes sense given your context, including your historical context. And then my job is, and then how do we shift your context?
How do we help you learn more?
Exactly. Yeah. So that something else is going to sort of naturally evolve out of that context.
Right, right.
Yeah, it does. It feels so sort of freeing. And I love that word you used, Tim. It just felt respectful to me in a way that, you know, I still love the relational work and attachment work and that stuff, but it didn't quite capture that something about sort of like humanity that was so beautiful to me.
Well, my experience of all of many of the other approaches is it describes it, but it doesn't tell you what to do.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've done this with consultees over and over. They'd be a beautiful psychodynamic, psychoanalytic, whatever description, you know, and we'll get to attachment disorder stuff. You know, they're attachment disordered. And it's like, okay, so what do?
Yeah.
Take them home with you and reparent them? That's a logical
thought process. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. From thinking about it that way. You have to repair it, redo it, you know?
So, right. Yeah.
Well, and some early forms of attachment therapy did attempt to engage in some of those things. I mean,
yeah.
The
holding therapies and the
rebirthing.
Sure. Rebirthing. Yeah. Yeah, you bet. But I mean, we look back on it and we're like, oh, that's disgusting and weird. But you have to consider, you know, in that worldview, Tim and I talked about this in another podcast, behaviorism was just basically lost to us clinically.
Yeah.
For years, for decades. About 3 to 4 years before I went into grad school, behavioral principles and learning theory was a core course for social workers in all social work schools, right?
Wow.
Right. It was fundamental training because social work said, this is the best way to think about it.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah,
And then CBT came.
Yeah. Right.
Which is also has great strength and great wonderfulness. But so when we're talking about people who are kind of, you know, in the 90s, late 80s, 90s, kind of flailing around, they don't actually have this available to them as a way to consider it. It's not there.
Yeah. And I certainly didn't have, like, I didn't ever have any sort of hardcore behavior analytic training in my grad school, even though my graduate program was fantastic and very integrative. You know, I had to get those things on my own afterwards, after actually I had gotten very interested in ACT. Then I decided for myself, like, oh, I think I want to understand some of the core behavioral principles better. And I don't want to like present something I'm not like, that's still not my area of expertise. So, you know.
In her mind.
In my mind.
Indeed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Jenna, how did you end up co-founding the Portland Psychotherapy Clinic?
Well, it's sort of a personal story, actually. So my my family lives about it lives in Washington State. And at the time that Jason and I were trying to figure out where we wanted to settle down, our first niece was about to be born. And it was really important to both Jason and I that we were within driving distance, because we knew we wanted to have a very close and sort of influential relationship with her and eventually my nephew, Michael. And that just wasn't going to happen if we were a plane flight away. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking to live in the Pacific Northwest. And Jason was looking for academic jobs. I was going to just go into private practice, not just go into private practice.
I was going to call you on that. Because it's such an easy job, Jenna.
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm on sabbatical right now. You know, you can do it forever. And there's no...
We want to talk about that, too, about what it's like to be on sabbatical.
I'm very happy to talk about that. But there are no PhD clinical programs in the Portland area. And so the closest one is down in Eugene, down at University of Oregon. And that's a good 4-5 hour drive from my family. So Jason said, how can I have the ability to work with students, to do training, to be able to do research, and how he does some, he did want to do some clinical work, but I wanted to do almost all clinical work. How do we do that when there isn't a university here for him to have a faculty position at? And from my perspective, you know, I have been trained in the scientist practitioner model, and, you know, with the idea of science integrating or research integrating into my clinical work and my clinical work influencing research as well, which is an important part of that dynamic. But I hadn't ever really seen it work that well. My faculty in graduate school, many of them did have small private practices, but it was very separate than their research work. So I was just sort of curious, like, could that ever work? And so Jason had, he is much more the business person than I am. So he had this idea of starting, it's built on a social enterprise model. So if you're familiar with like B Corps or social enterprise, the idea is that you have a for-profit company, but rather than the bottom line being only making money, you have what's called a triple bottom line. And so the triple bottom line is you make money, you contribute to the broader community, and you care for the environment. So that's sort of the triple bottom line that you have in a social enterprise. So social enterprise is using the profits of a for-profit to fund social good.
Yeah.
And so that's how we set up Portland Psychotherapy. So all of the profits from our clinical work and our training, so anything that generates money, goes back into funding social science research or psychosocial research. So we don't chase grants. We don't write any grants.
That's amazing.
It is really nice, which means we get to do the kind of research that fits our values rather than doing the kind of research that NIH is currently interested in funding, which changes all of the time. And it provides.
You can also go to, you can do topics that are kind of orphaned by that process.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's how it started. We, our very first year, we brought in a postdoc. Chad Drake was actually our very first postdoc.
No way. He's so cool.
Chad is such a cool human. Oh my God.
Wonderful human. And I might embarrass him about this, but you know, we were working on a shoestring and on his research days. So it's a half research, half clinical postdoc. He and Jason were working out of our home doing their research. But Chad was very excited because Chad likes food and I like cooking. So I would just make extra food the night before, and Chad loved going in and having leftovers. So I think he thought that was the only perk of the post. Of course. So we have come a long way since Chad working.
I like to get Chad on the podcast.
Yes,
yeah. he's probably do that too. Yeah.
Wonderful human. So that's how it started. And now we obviously have grown pretty significantly. But it's still kind of based on the same principles, same model, and it's working really well. Yeah.
So for anybody out there who is like I'm just imagining somebody who's a clinician, who's like driving in their car, listening to this conversation and feeling really inspired by what you're saying, because like, Jenna, you live your values. Like, it's so cool to see, you know, like the type of lifestyle you live, the type of clinic you run, the type of trainings you give, even the type of house that you live in, right? Like, I mean, like you're walking the walk. Like, you're the real deal. And I mean that with the utmost like respect and humility. You know, like I really am inspired. And so if somebody else is kind of thinking like, how can I do this and brighten my corner of the world that I'm living in, right? Like, you know, start doing this sort of three bottom lines. Like, how would you recommend like getting involved with research if you're not attached to a university? How would you recommend thinking about business in this more broader way that isn't just about living paycheck to paycheck?
Yeah. So, I mean, research may not be the way that you want to contribute to your community. That was just simply our way of saying, we want to give back to the broader community. And the way we want to give back, one way we want to give back is to contribute to science, like science that matters to us. But what I would say is, I'll answer the research part of it in just a second, but like, even if you're not interested in research, like thinking about your own, if you're in private practice, or your own life as, how do I do this in a way that isn't about depriving myself of, like, you know, I mean, you talk about the lifestyle that I live, and yet, like, I just took a 5-month sabbatical traveling around the world. It's not like I'm depriving myself of things, but I think that when values are so incorporated into just like how we make our decisions, then the idea of like, oh, how do I do this in a way that also contributes to the broader society? Or, you know, how do I buy office supplies from a local supplier versus Walmart or something like that? Just sort of becomes a way you start making decisions about things. So that's what I would say is like, find your way of giving back to the broader community through what you're already doing. As far as research goes, it's getting a heck of a lot easier to do research outside of a university because of things like Google Scholar and our public libraries now, many of them have PsychLit or PsychInfo at them. So it is much easier in that way. I would say that one of the things we're learning is that collaboration is helpful.
I was going to ask about that. When you don't have a university association, are your papers considered at the same level, you know, by peer review? I mean, do you have to like kind of push harder to get published?
Push harder. I don't think we have to push harder. The one question that people often ask about the research is, what do you do about IRB?
That's my big question. I collect a lot of data, but what do you do with IRB?
Yeah. And so what we did was,
for people who don't know,
institutional review board.
Like human ethics. Like if you're going to do anything with human beings, this has got to be reviewed.
Yeah, thank Milgram. So after Milgram and all of that stuff, you know, when you are doing research, your research has to, in order to get it published in...
We're talking about the prison experiments, right?
Yes.
Stanford prison experiments, which, you know, Milgram ran. 40. Really destructive.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was Zimbardo, and Milgram was the shocking people.
Oh, the shocking people thing, okay. Yes.
But, you know,
it wasn't so great either.
No. But so any research, in order to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, or, you know, at least a reputable one, has to go through an IRB and have it approved that it's ethical. And IRBs are almost always only found at universities. That's what people think of with an IRB.
That's what I think of.
Yeah, yeah. And even when we've done some talks about our model and how to do research outside of academia, and people will still even say like, oh, I don't think in my country that's legal. And I thought, I think you should probably check, because I think most people think it's not legal, but it is. So what we did was, there's actually no law that says an IRB has to be a part of a university. It's just that's who has done it, universities and hospitals.
Yeah.
And so we just, and by we, again, this is mainly Jason, but just got together with, I think there were six other, maybe seven other research practitioners around the country and created our own IRB. And so, yeah, cool. And you know, had a lawyer drop. And I actually think there's an article that's just about to come out about creating our own IRB process. And now, you know, we have rotating board members on that IRB that review all of the research for each of the member organizations. And, you know, it's so you can do those things, but you just have to sort of think outside of the box. Because I think everybody used to think, well, the only way to do research in practice is to also have an affiliation with the university. And there are downsides with that. You know, universities may not want to support the kind of research that we're wanting to do, for example. Not that we're doing, you know, problematic research, but it gives you more independence.
You might be doing, you know, like I said, orphaned research, places yeah. where most people don't look.
Exactly. Or
they're not writing about.
Yeah, right. So that's how you do that. That's a big stumbling block people think about when doing research in outside of academia.
And I appreciate that you continue to publish about the process of what you're doing.
Yeah.
I used to be a facilitator on a ACT peer support network. And we were using one of the papers published from the Portland Psychotherapy Clinic on your peer skill building model. We called it the Portland model, and we rocked that thing for a couple of years. I think they're still using it in the ACT peer network. And it's just like that paper right there was just so valuable, right? Like to be able to see that process and how you were creating a system of developing skills amongst peers, right? How do you take things outside of the workshop environment?
Thank you for saying that, Tim. And I think that goes back to this idea of people being able to give back. Like I don't know that had I not sort of immersed myself in this world of, you know, a social enterprise and thinking about my work in that way, I don't know that I would have necessarily thought, oh, wait a second, we created a lot of people in the Portland community, not we, Jenna and Jason, a lot of people in the Portland community came up with what we think is this really cool model for doing peer supervision. But it's going to die with us if we don't put it out there. And so, you know, I don't know, however many authors are on that paper, five of us or something like that, just wrote it up. And now we actually have people like around the world saying, oh, we use the Portland model. And that's just like one tiny little way that anybody could sort of give back in some small way. It does not have to be this grand, big $10 million grant research.
And the Portland model paper will be in the show notes, correct?
Yes.
Well, and yes, actually there, if people are interested in the model of the social enterprise model of Portland Psychotherapy, we have a couple papers on that too. So I can give you those.
That you also have a lot of information about what you're doing on your website too. So we probably need to talk about that too, that there's really vast amounts of information.
Yeah, your website is very cool. I actually use it as a reference tool quite regularly, actually. Even there's even resources on there about compassion and how it mixes with perspective taking. It's very forward-thinking kind of stuff.
cool. Yeah, we really like to be able to create resources that we think other people might be able to use. Because again, like our impact is so tiny. If it's just me and my clients, it's so, so tiny. The thing I get excited about is this idea of the ripple effect. Like that's what I love about clinical work. I like seeing the change in my client's life. But what really gets me jazzed is thinking about, wait, she's going to go home and she's going to have relationships with all these other people that are then going to be impacted, that are then going to, you know, it's that kind of ripple effect that makes it worth it to me. Because otherwise, if it's just like me and one other person, you know, this is probably not worth the heartache that being a almost full-time clinician is, because it's a hard job.
Yeah, it really
is. Do you find it reinforcing, Jenna, like to get that kind of feedback from people? Or like, I remember the first time that I talked to you and Jason about the fact that the peer intervision, like the ACT peer support network that we were using, we called it the Portland model. And I remember, I forget if it was you or Jason, we were like, oh, that's kind of cool, the Portland model.
Right, absolutely. And you know what's really cool is coming back to people who are in that consult group and saying, hey, do you know we were just at WorldCon and people were saying, oh yeah, we are using the Portland model. And then they get jazzed about it too. So I do think, and actually this is going to take us in a little bit of a maybe tangent, but related. If I think about what I most appreciate about the ACT community, so other than just sort of the model, it is that idea of generosity. I just really think there's so many people in this CBS community. I didn't mean to say ACT community. I meant to say CBS, contextual behavioral science community, that like just really want to prop other people up and give it away. And I love that about the community. And so I love it that, you know, there are a bunch of clinicians in Portland who have never had the opportunity to go to WorldCon or, you know, publish a paper, who feel like, oh, somebody in the UK is using the model that we helped create here in Portland. That's awesome. Yeah. So.
WorldCon is the yearly gathering of the entire community. In one year, it's in the U.S. or the North America, and the next year, it's overseas and internationally someplace.
Yeah.
And it's been going on for how many years? How many? What are we on to? Like 20?
Was this year 16, Tim?
16, yeah.
16 wow. This year, yeah. But then there were... we did a few summer institutes. I don't think those are counted in the WorldCon. So, you know, it's close to 16, 18 years that they have been, ACBS has been gathering.
I think that's what I went to the first time. I think I went to a summer institute in Reno.
I think you did. I somehow remember seeing, like, that's where I picture you. That and a FAP consult group as well.
Oh, really? We were in a FAP? We were.
The online one, or a FAP training, not a consult group.
That was wild, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
You know, I'd really like to, this is cool, I love talking about this, but I think it'd be really useful for the clinicians in the world, who are listening to this. I'm pretty sure every clinician is going, okay, fine, but what about the going on sabbatical thing? How do you actually do that? How did it work? I think it's a really powerful thing. I think it's very, very rare for private practitioners.
Oh yeah.
Except when they're having children, babies, to leave for a long period of time and then come back.
Yeah.
Especially with the clients that you work with who are, you know, usually fairly complex trauma people.
Yeah.
Even in the US, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I've noticed that, like maternity or paternity leaves in the US are shockingly short.
Yeah.
That's because we don't need it. We're Americans. We're Americans.
Americans.
We're tough.
Yeah. Let's see. So I guess maybe I can tell you a little bit about where the idea came from and then how we actually did it or are doing it.
We meaning you and your clients?
Jason and I both. And
I'm interested in how you and your clients did it too.
Yeah. So the idea actually came from a TED Talk that we watched many years ago. And I don't even remember the person's name, but he owns a design company. And he said that he realized the average American has, I don't know, something like 7 years after they retire until their health starts failing significantly. And he thought, well, what if I took those 7 years and didn't just shove them at the end of my life, but what if I took them and kind of spread them out? So he actually closes his entire office, all of his staff close down, I think it's once every 5 years or something like that, for an entire year. And during that year, they get all of their like creative juices flowing, and then they come back and they just do the work for the next 5 or 7 years, whatever. So that sort of got us thinking. And so this is something that we have been planning for probably about 4 years. And I think there are two big hurdles to
planning for financially, planning for, right. Yes. Okay.
So it's both, the two big hurdles are, how do you make this work financially in your life? And then how do you make this work clinically with the people that you serve?
Right.
Essentially what I did clinically was I terminated with all of my clients. Yeah.
Over what period of time?
I started telling many of the people that, you know, I have some people that it wasn't going to be a big deal, but not very many. But I started telling most people about a year ahead, saying my plan is that I'm going to be on sabbatical. What I had said was because I wanted to give myself the freedom of coming back and doing something very different, because that's part of sabbatical, is like having this creative time to consider what you want to do, where that's part of it for me. I said, I find it very, you know, clinical work is where my heart lies. I find it very hard to imagine that I'm going to come back from sabbatical and not do any clinical work, but it may change significantly how I do my work. And so for that reason, I think it makes sense for us to actually end this piece of work that we're doing. And I gave them referrals and transferred them to other providers.
You did it over the course of the year. It wasn't like the last month everybody said goodbye.
Oh, no. Over the course of the year. And so that's something you actually have to plan on financially, is like, it's not that I just stopped seeing clients the last day of work. It's, you know, they're trickling off for months ahead of time. And then when I will come back in January, you know, my work actually, I think, will be radically different than it was before, which I'm excited about. But
I'd really like to hear about that. If you can talk about that, that'd be really interesting.
Sure. But then I said,
finish your thought now.
And so when I was terminating with clients, I really did feel like it was important for them to sort of see this not as we're just taking a break, but this is an ending of a relationship, because I think that's something we don't get to do very often in our lives, is learn how to end things. And also with the idea of, you know, if there's another piece of work for you to do, and it seems like I'm the right person to do that piece of work with you in the future, let's talk about that. Like, this isn't a death, but this is an ending for this piece of work. So that's how I did that with my clients. Yeah.
Not just this piece of work, but this, when I end with my students, I always say, you know, I may see you at conferences, you know, we may connect in other ways, but what we have done this year together, we're ending. This is
exactly
this space that we created together is coming to a close.
Absolutely.
Is that what you said? Kind of like that?
Yeah. And I think that is a very, very valuable experience, both for the clinician and the client, to be able to go through of how do you end well?
You know? Absolutely. What a great topic.
Yeah.
I think in the FAP community, there's a lot of conversation about the good goodbye.
Yeah. But often in clinical, I think one of the things I found tricky was usually when I have done that in clinical work, it's because my client has gotten to a place that they're done, like at least for now.
Yep.
And this was not that we had got, not with all of my clients, that we had gotten to a place where they felt like they were ready to be done, but it was because of something in my life. And so that's also a tricky part of it is like, how do you have a good ending when it's maybe even a premature ending, like not the ending you would choose?
Or for your client, it's a reenactment in some ways, or a recueing, or a reminder.
Yeah.
Of, you know, I not having their needs matter.
Absolutely.
Which is not the case. I'm absolutely sure that's not how you are approaching it. But what we intend and how it lands are often quite different.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you speak to that a little bit? Maybe the people who were, as you feel is respectful to your clients, the people who really, this was a very, very difficult, challenging, probably maybe one of the hardest things they've done in their life to do.
Yeah.
Have you leave?
Yeah. I can think of a couple in particular that I just knew it was going to land with them as, oh, see, here's another person leaving me right in the middle of like all of my stuff. Here's another person leaving me. And so I think the part that was easier for me, part that was more comfortable, was helping process that with my client. Because that's, that's sort of what we do as clinicians. It's like, how do you stay present with that and try and help them sort of grieve in the process of the relationship ending? Oh, I think you're muted, Joanne.
Also to see it as similar, not the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So that was, and I think those clients for whom it was most difficult, they also probably gained the most out of that process.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also think one thing that is really hard in that process is me as therapist also sort of valuing my own wants and decisions and needs. Like it would have been very, very easy for me and probably what I would naturally do to say to a few of my clients, yes, but if you get into a real crisis, here's how you get a hold of me while I'm gone. And okay, we say we're ending now, but yes, yes, I'll be coming back and you can always work with me in the future. Those would be the things that would fit just sort of naturally with me, but it's not what would have worked for me.
I think it would fit with anyone who is a clinician.
Absolutely.
So what I'm hearing you say is you didn't just stop clinical work. For a period of time, you have stopped being a clinician.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, for a lot of us, once we start, that's what we do until we retire.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I had no contact with clients at all while I was, maybe two or three clients did, from long ago would do the like, hey, I'm just checking in, letting you know how my life is going. But I had no contact from former clients. It was all sort of routed through our admin staff at the clinic. And it was very, I will tell you, when I left for sabbatical, it had been a hard couple of years sort of professionally and at the clinic leading up to leaving. And I had fantasies of like, maybe I'll go on sabbatical and I'll come back and I'll go to, culinary school, or maybe maybe I won't do clinical work.
Yeah.
And this is something that I tell my clients all the time. I tell them it's really, really good to be missed. And it's really good to miss somebody. It tells you something about what you care about when you're like longing for somebody. Or something, right? And it was pretty, like, you know, the first few months of sabbatical, I was, you know, very happy to be, you know, on an island sitting there. Right, exactly. And I profoundly missed being a clinician. I still really miss it because I'm not seeing clients right now still. And I love that.
What do you miss?
I miss the intense sort of interpersonal interaction, connection that I have. And I miss being able to see people grow in a really profound way that I don't get to see.
I'm thinking about those conversations you and I had a few years ago that, you know, were technically so bad that we could never get them anywhere. Tim listened to me. He's like, oh no, this is bad. Content's great.
These were an earlier iteration of the podcast.
Yeah,
right. And what we were talking about, I was just sharing with each other how the incredible joy and the incredible, what would you call it? Just how much it takes to be a clinician.
Yeah.
From the clinician.
Yeah.
But how worthwhile it is. I mean, I remember us saying to each other that we both, and well, you're going to do what you're going to do, that we both know that we've saved people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
People's lives. Yeah. And being in that kind of place with another human being is so profound. It's so profound.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there was something about being able, for me, being able to take a step away from that, to get back in touch with, oh, when I don't have that in my life, there's something like very missing for me. Like, I want that piece to be a part of my life in a different way, probably kind of going forward for me. But I think that was a very important lesson for me. And the only way I was able to do that was because I allowed myself that freedom of not coming back and doing clinical work, to actually having it be, okay, no, I'm ending this now. And then we'll see what happens when I...
So you're really ending a huge part of your life at this point. Like you've been a clinician, what, 25, 30 years?
I've been a clinician for 20-ish years. Yeah.
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 I mean, and you know, that's like half your life.
Right. Yeah. That's generous. Yeah.
and it's hard work.
It's very difficult.
What did you say, Tim?
It's hard work.
Yeah.
It's good work, but it's hard work.
Yeah. And I think it's hard in a way that people who aren't clinicians don't get. I think many people would say, like, everybody says to me, oh my gosh, you're a therapist or you're a clinician. That must be so hard, listening to people complain about their lives all day. I'm like, that is not the hard part.
No.
That's not the hard part. Yeah.
Like that. If that's what I felt I were doing, like, that would be pretty easy. That is not the hard part of the work. You know, the hard part is investing, for me, the way that I work is I'm really investing my heart in this person's life, and I care about them so profoundly, deeply, and to sit with suffering in that context is really, really difficult, and staying present to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the hard part for me. But it's also the stuff.
One of the other things you and I talked about, Jenna, I'm remembering, that was such a great conversation.
It was such a great conversation.
was the sense that whether you're working or not, your clients are there.
Absolutely.
Considering them, thinking about them, being reminded of them. And I'm just wondering if distance and separation for that length of time, that kind of attending dissipated for you.
It did. It's interesting. So you know, you're saying like there, and that's how it feels as a clinician. It's like I'm thinking about and processing, and like they're always sort of there. That definitely has dissipated. I would say they're still here. Like I still
absolutely
think about my clients in this like heartfelt way. And I have this sense of like,
I'm the kind of like, okay, this is what we're working on. And this, that seems like it would be important to, that's gone.
Yeah. It sort
or dissipated.
Yeah. And it's interesting because on sabbatical, it wasn't like I was still working. I'm in the process of writing a book. So
what are you writing about?
Yeah, I'm writing a values book. Jason and I are writing a values book together.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I was working every day and you know, thinking about the stuff that really matters to me, writing a values book. But it was in a very different way than how my normal clinical life is of thinking about it on a one-on-one relational piece versus how do I take all of that and then put it down in a book. So, yeah.
So the service, the connecting, the being of service didn't end for you. The form of it changed.
Yeah. And
well, wait, let me just back up, you know, because I think there's always the service piece you're talking about in terms of the structure of your business and everything like the structure of your life. But I'm wondering if there's, how can I articulate this? That the relational sort of power is not there the way it is when you're doing clinical work. The caring about it, the meaningfulness is there. What do you think?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think that is really accurate, that that there's something about being in relationship. Uh-huh. Because even as I'm writing the book, it's a very personal book with like lots of personal stories and stories about my clients that I care about. And I find, you know, I'm sitting at the library every day working, and I'm crying as I'm working. Yeah, and everybody's staring at me like, are you okay? So it's very like heartfelt for me, but it isn't kind of a two-way relationship. Like
right, exactly.
My person that I was writing about yesterday and tearing up at the library, she doesn't know I was like having this sort of connection with her. And I miss that part.
Yeah.
That's not there, not doing clinical work.
Yeah. So I have another question that really struck me. My clients and I, you know, I'm getting older and I'm planning on retiring at some point, 10 years from now.
actually,
this is a real thing for me. It's not like, oh yeah, 10 years from now, but really meaning 30.
Yeah.
You know,
yes.
I'm starting to count down like, yeah, it's probably going to be 10 years from now. And clients and I are talking about what it will be like to not have access to a person who knows more about them, their lives, what they've been through than anyone on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, how that is. I mean, going to another therapist is doable, right?
Absolutely. But
that long sort of nuanced history where I know you've had this with a client will say something and all of us, all the context and all of the meaning just boom opens for you.
Yep.
And you don't have to walk through it with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering about that, how your clients, because they may not come back to you. You may not be there when they come back.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Another thing my clients have talked about is how weird it will be to know that I am in the world and for them to not have access to me.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
One woman said it'd be better if you died. And she meant it in the best. No.
Totally.
She really meant it, not like in a horror.
Yeah, no, but I get that.
I gave her a lot of shit about it when she said it. But I mean, what she was meaning is it's so complicated for me to manage that.
Could I tell a personal story? So I, a couple years ago, ran for city council. And
in all your spare time.
In all my spare time, yeah. Well, to be honest, some local advocacy groups had said, like, Tim, you know, we live in a very conservative kind of lunchbox kind of area, and there isn't somebody talking about how this beautiful city that we live in, that's full of a lot of marginalized folks, doesn't have a single affordable housing plan, and we talk about, it's disturbing. And so, they were saying like, it would be great to have you, this really outspoken, kind of a shit disturber kind of person who could really, speak to these kinds of issues. And I'm going to be really real with both of you. I was never intending on winning. I never was. And I didn't realize how much this would impact my clients.
Oh.
Because they were like, but what if you win and you become a career, like you're a young guy and you become a career politician, right? And then I'm going to lose you.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of legit grief. And it's funny because I have some clients who are dealing with issues that therapy hasn't worked out for them in the past, whether they're, complex trauma, have, some severe histories and they have difficulties making relationships.
Or you're dealing with people who've been assaulted and betrayed by therapists.
Yeah,
absolutely. Or working with folks who identify as a gender or a sexual minority and have even gone to, apparently, queer friendly therapists where it just, they haven't been able to get that kind of connection. And, I've had frank, conversations in this room where they're like, what the hell am I supposed to do?
And what a reasonable and what a wonderful thing for clients to be able to say, like, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a powerful healing place to be in for people.
Oh, and my clients had this really rich opportunity because, you mentioned, Joanne, the only time that is sort of the socially acceptable time for you to take off a large chunk of time would be if you were having a child.
Exactly. And or if you have an ailing family member or something like that.
Yeah.
And from
your ailing, like if you get cancer, but not too bad.
Yes.
You can take off some time.
And from my client's perspective, this is not what was happening, but from my client's perspective, I'm going on vacation for a year.
Oh no, so Jen's going to get a holiday
on the beach. That's their fantasy.
And
like,
I would suspect that there may be people who are listening to this podcast who actually think of it that way too.
It really isn't that way.
I know that. We know that. We get that. But that quality. And like when I first heard it, I was like, I don't want to do that.
Now, I'm not downplaying it. Like getting to write your book while you're on the Sardinian coastline is better than getting to write your book while you're in your normal regular office.
Rub it in, Jenna.
just get the salt out and here's the wound. Just rub it, Jenna.
So I'm not trying to say, oh, poor's me, I was working the whole time. But, in my client's fantasy, this was like, really, that's more important to you to go on vacation than I am. It was something that we had to deal with. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's such a rich place to work and to attend to, and it sounds to me like you're sort of feeling guilty or somehow selfish or any of that stuff was there, but it wasn't directing how you were interacting.
I think that was something that I really had to, I really stumbled with in the beginning. I was going through this process for about a year with some of my clients.
Right.
And it was not very graceful in the beginning.
Gosh, no. You're flailing around together.
Right. Yeah. I think I was probably defensive, or they would say something, I'm like, well, it's not really like, I wouldn't do it like that, but I would feel
what I hear you saying is default into stupid therapist mode, right?
And so I had to actually, and this is part of where the values piece comes back in, like connect with what were my values that were guiding me to taking this kind of shift in my life for a period of time and going on sabbatical. And that because it was a values driven thing, that made it sort of honorable in a way, as opposed to just I'm sorry to all of those people out there who said this to me, but every time somebody said to me, oh, you deserve it, I just wanted to scream. When people would say, Oh, I'm going on sabbatical. Oh, you work so hard, you deserve it.
Yeah.
Because like my response to that is, I deserve it? No, like the single mom who has three jobs and is trying to like still take care of her kids, she's the one that deserves, if this is a-
I just found out her mom has cancer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if this is a deserving thing.
Right.
So for me, it couldn't be about, well, you know, I deserve to take care of myself. It had to be tied to values that are really important to me.
Well, it's also, I think, like demonstrating what we're asking clients to do in a very, very direct and profound way.
Absolutely.
We say to our clients all the time, you know, you, what you need and what you want is important.
Yeah.
You know? And so, but I'm going to be, I don't do this, but I'm going to be available 24/7 and I'm going to extend my sessions and I'm not going to ask you to pay me.
Right.
But you, you need to, you know, and I think, I think one of the things that's very powerful is having pristine self-respecting boundaries with clients.
Yeah.
And for them to say, oh, that's what that looks like. That's how you do that.
Beautiful bit of modeling.
Many of us may not be able to go on a year sabbatical.
Yeah.
That sabbaticalizing around boundaries, around limits, around I am a human being too.
Right.
So important.
Yeah, it kind of actually goes back to where we started with this idea of like the shift for me in seeing behaviorism as something that I wanted to identify with was that humanizing thing. I am not categorically different than my clients. And so if I am working with my clients to sort of honor their humanity, then I'm also a human in the room with all my own messy stuff.
That is not allowed to be honored.
Right. Yeah.
Because we know we're not supposed to bring our stuff into the room when we're
doing it. Oh,
no.
I didn't get that memo.
And don't make the therapy about us, right?
Right.
So did you I think I asked all the questions I wanted to ask about that, just how you and your, actually I'm going to come back to that thing about being the witness in someone's life in such a profound and different way that no one else, for the most part, more than likely, will ever be.
Yeah.
How did you carry that away? Or I don't know if away is the right relation, right word. When the relationship ended, that honor in many ways.
Yeah.
That singularity that you are for this person is still there in some ways.
Yeah, I don't see it as, I mean, I think how you just said it sort of answers the question. It's still there. Like I still am the person who holds all of that for them. And
they can't access it. They can't. Oh. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but that's a different need. So there's one need of having people in your life, I think, people in your life who know you and get you and who you don't have to go through the whole rigmarole when you say like, oh, this thing, like, forget it. Mm-hmm. That's one need. But I do think there is a need of just sort of like being known by an other, like having somebody that knows all of you or all of you that you chose to share.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's still there. Like my clients still have somebody out there in the world who like knows all of them, and they may never have that.
I just want to share something that actually happened yesterday. A client and I were talking about this issue, and she said, but really, you know everything about me. I told you everything, but in that process of telling you, I told me.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and that does, we don't take that with us when we go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. God, don't you love it?
It's only when a man's personal events are of interest to another that they become of an interest to themselves.
Totally.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Love that.
Beautiful.
I know. Man, very wise things I learn from my clients.
Right. Exactly.
So,
absolutely. Yeah. This is the best job in the world.
Except when it's really not.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's, hey, it's hard work. It's good work.
It's hard work. It's meaningful work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jenna, are you too polite when people say like, oh, it must be so hard to just listen to people complain all day? Are you too polite to correct them and be like, yeah, that's not what I do?
No, I correct them.
I love it.
And actually, the reason why I correct them is because I feel like it's disrespectful to my clients.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I have a responsibility, but like, I also am sort of this, a bit of a mama bear type. And it's like, oh no, you didn't just do that. You don't get to disrespect my clients is sort of how I, so I definitely.
And it's also, I think, standing up against the sort of diminishing and disrespecting culture does for this work.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't see any images in the media of me as a therapist, right? I see crazy people. I see people who are, right? There's no, and no, even if you see people doing therapy, it's like, oh God, no, ick, right?
Absolutely.
And you always know they're going to eventually sleep with their client.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's just how it always ends. Right.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I agree. So I do very much correct people.
Yeah, I do too.
I love it. That's very cool.
Not so much.
Yeah.
Do you correct people, Tim?
It's interesting because I'm noticing that like I'm having this sort of thing, like the two of you don't, well, Joanne, you know me pretty well, like personally. So I, you know, I'm a bit of a smart ass. And so my typical response.
I know that about you, Tim.
Yes.
Yeah, this is not a secret.
You don't have to know you that personally to get that.
good point. Yeah. So typically when people say things like that to me, I tend to, give them a bit of a hard time, and I'll just sort of be like, huh, yeah, you know, it's like anything, you know, Star Wars, it's a movie about a bad dad, you know? Yeah, like I like to get really reductionist on them about things. Uh-huh. You know, and I think it comes from a similar place of like, no, that is not what the work is about. And I do feel very protectionist about the courage that people have to do this work. And also to celebrate that vulnerability, because we, as you were saying, Joanne, like our media presentations of therapists, we don't really celebrate that work. Yeah, it is insulting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, and I don't know if this is just kind of a male sort of socialized thing. But, you know, I like to use a lot of words like, you know, we do like hard work. We do a lot of heavy lifting. And I'll even say to my clients, like, you know, you're the one who's doing the heavy lifting. Like, I'm just kind of showing up and encouraging
spotting you.
Spotting. I like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I totally, I'm a big.
You know, another thing occurs to me when that person is saying that to us, oh, it's like listening to people complain. There may be a part of them that's thinking maybe therapy is something that I might benefit from.
Oh, interesting.
But it's just sitting with somebody and complaining about things.
Yeah.
And to have the other response back of like, this, no, that's not what we do. One of the things I say is kind of like, yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, midwifery is mostly about screaming and blood.
Good one.
I think you've been.
That kind of stops the conversation.
Yeah.
Just so you know.
We actually, in when we train other clinicians, I'll often do this exercise. And maybe, Joanne, if you've been in one of my trainings, you've seen this. But I do this exercise. It's kind of hard to describe here. But it's about kind of writing down the thing you feel sort of is most shameful or the thing you would never want anybody to know about you. And you write it on a piece of paper and then kind of I walk around and ask the person, like, are you willing to give this to me? And what would it be like for me to read this and read it out loud? And I do that because, like, that is what my clients...
That's what we're asking clients to do.
Absolutely. So if you see therapy as people complaining versus you seeing people, therapy as people saying, hell yeah, let's do this work so I can be a better partner and human being and including to myself.
Just stay alive.
Yeah, just say, like, those are two very different things. And so I really like people to get, I don't it isn't about, I'm not working with people who are complaining. I'm working with people who are working.
I say it that too a lot in a way, not like that's beautiful. And I think I've done something like that with you, but you know, after a while, the trainings start to blur together, right?
Yeah.
I'll steal that too, by the way. But I, you know, I'll say to people, you know, this work isn't about what color BMW you want to buy.
Oh God.
That's not what I do.
Yeah.
There are therapists who do that.
Yep. Sure.
I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
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 Hey, before we wrap up, there's been a theme.
Do we have to wrap up? Noticing. That sucks.
I know.
What's wrong with this wrapping up shit, Tim? Why do we have to do that?
I know,
we just
right?
hang out all morning and chat?
Absolutely.
Hey, I'm on sabbatical.
Yeah.
There's been a theme to our conversation that I've really appreciated. And I just wanted to point this out and see if either of you would like to find some words to maybe help us kind of sum up this conversation. But like we're identifying this ongoing process of how this work evolves for us over time and our relationships with clients, and even how we do some perspective taking and going behind clients' eyes and seeing how they see us. And I'm just wondering, like, what is it? If there's any last words, like what do we want to share with therapists who are out there, who are listening to this podcast, who are maybe trying to get something, even just like commiserating and connecting with us and the ins and outs of this work? Like, what is it that we might want to share with somebody who's out there struggling with this work, who's maybe even feeling isolated? I hear this all the time. I was this person for a long time, the only ACT person in their clinic, the only ACT person in their city, in their region, you know, who's courageously chosen to walk this path of doing this geeky behavioral work and to be steeped in like acceptance and values. I mean, what do you folks think? Like, what would we want to share with those people before we
share something that happened after our conversations, Jenna? You know, I had some audio tape and I asked your permission to share it with some people. And each person I shared it with said that they were, one woman said she was listening to it, nodding her head and crying.
Oh, I make people cry. Why do I make people cry?
No. What she was saying was just that sense of like, oh, it's not just me.
Yeah.
It's not just me. And I really hope that we can do some of that in this podcast for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. What would you say, Jenna?
Yeah, you know, this may be because it's just sort of what's currently brewing in my head in the work that I'm kind of working on right now. There's something for me about acknowledging that pain or struggle that we like, how difficult it is, that brings honor to our willingness to do it.
Right. Dignifying the pain.
Yeah, I think I had often thought about it as, yeah, it's really, really hard work, but I'm sort of cut out for this stuff and I can withstand it. And I think it has shifted more for me, more like, yeah, this is really hard work. And that's part of what makes it so meaningful. It's like, you know, the idea of like, people don't climb Everest just for the view. Like, it's not the same.
I love that.
You know what? It's not the same if you just like helicopter in and get dropped off at the top and take your little selfie. Like, there is something about going through a struggle together and going through your own struggle of doing this work that is difficult that like actually brings the meaning to it. Because I think of the clinicians that I know, and maybe this isn't fair to them, but from like what they have talked to me about, who aren't kind of as, it's not as difficult for them, the work. It's
Can I stop, pop for a second? Doing clinical work as a job.
Yes.
Doing clinical work as a career. Wait.
Yes.
And then doing clinical work as your life's work.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And you're talking about, we talked about doing clinical work as our life's work. It may not be the only life's work, but it's definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that if I'm doing it as a job, that's fine. And there are benefits to that. I don't think you get the same meaning. And I think doing it as life's work comes at different costs.
Yeah.
But I definitely do get the meaning part out of it. And I think part of that comes through the struggle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm climbing up Everest. I'm not getting dropped on the top, you know, in my helicopter.
I love that. You don't climb Everest for the view. So much stuff I can steal. How about you, Tim? Isn't it great?
Absolutely. This has been awesome.
Thank you.
Jenna, would you be willing to come back?
Absolutely. Anytime. I'm always happy to chat with
that
you.
That would be so awesome.
Maybe when I'm back seeing clients too.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. I would love to hear that piece of it.
Yeah, and what it's like restarting a practice. That's what I'll be doing. Yeah.
So will you make a commitment to us that we can do that when you get back to work? And
absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, you made it through, Jenna. Joanne, we did it again. Another episode of Act in Context. Jenna, thank you.
We formed this third personality, Tim and I. That's actually kind of cool.
I'm enjoying it. I really like our time together, Joanne.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you folks. So
take care. Have a good afternoon, evening, more, whatever you're doing, wherever you are.
Have a great day, everybody. Thank you so much to our listeners. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you stay updated on the latest episode. Take care, everybody.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.